This is the Nietzsche Podcast. Dionysus versus the Crucified. In Ecce Homo and in Nietzsche's notes, collected in The Will to Power, Nietzsche described this phrase as the essence of his philosophy. From the very beginning of his career, Nietzsche's worldview was profoundly influenced by his perception of a completely different set of moral sentiments, a completely different perspective on the world, which came out of what he called the Antica Morale, the whole morality of antiquity. And specifically, he finds it in the Hellenic Greek civilization, what he calls a tragic outlook on life, a pessimism of strength, as he defines it. This worldview is exemplified in the dramatic tragedies in which the Greek heroes are inevitably doomed to suffer and die. The tragic outlook affirmed life in all its suffering. And Nietzsche says that these Greek tragedies came out of the Hellenic spirit of excess. This was a culture established on the basis of that excess. They had a cruel morality in which comfort was regarded as a danger, labor was regarded as a disgrace, pity was regarded as contemptible, and madness and violence were seen as almost sacred. That's the tragic, the Antica Morale, the pessimism of strength, the Dionysian. These terms are all related for Nietzsche, a worldview that recognizes violence as a force that helps to establish and maintain culture. It's a worldview that celebrates life and culture along with all the violence in it, and sanctions violence in certain circumstances, and commemorates this violence in its myth and ritual. What Nietzsche calls the morality of the crucified, meanwhile, is the morality that revolts against this Antica Morale. And this morality takes the historical form of Christianity, the religion of Jesus, the God on the cross, the God who became man and was crucified. This is a religion in which nonviolence is preached. Rather than vengeance, forgiveness. Rather than the group using violence against the individual in order to maintain culture, Christianity preaches the innocence of the martyred individual. It teaches us to turn the other cheek. Nietzsche sees this as what he calls the slave revolt in morality, an oppressed underclass that creates this morality based on forgiveness because the ones who first preached and fostered the religion were themselves victimized and unable to take revenge against those who victimized and oppressed them. So in a sense, they were forced to forgive, and thus they declare that only the path of forgiveness is good and the path of vengeance is bad, evil, sinful, wicked. Christianity as a world religion is thus unique in this respect. It is the ultimate expression of siding with the weak, with the victim, against the victimizers. It presents to us a world in which, as Nietzsche describes the Christian vision, quote, the just man is tortured to death. Power is rejected, use of violence is rejected. And thus, as a consequence, so Nietzsche's criticism goes, the method that mankind has always utilized to establish and maintain culture is also rejected. Christianity uproots the tragic worldview. It doesn't affirm this life in all its suffering. Rather, it turns its attention to the redemption from said suffering found beyond this life. And the result is that Christianity becomes an anti-worldly religion. And Nietzsche's entire career can be seen as an attempt to counterpose the worldly religions of the pre-Christian era, exemplified in his mind by the Greek pagans, as an opposing perspective to the Christian worldview that rules European modernity. Nietzsche certainly seems to take sides in the conflict. In absentia of the exercise of worldly power, of the ability to take revenge, we encounter the psychological poison of ressentiment, in which one feels that they wish to lash out, to hurt the one who has hurt them, but they cannot actually do it. They cannot actually act out their revenge. The desire to hurt is felt rather than acted. Ressentiment, or resentment in English, is the word for this psychological state, which prompts one to, among other things, craft an imaginary revenge for one's enemies. This inner drama produces bad conscience, or guilt as we say it in plain language, as the person in question knows that their desire for revenge is itself a sin, and they feel that they should forgive, but know that they cannot. The entire Christian religion is driven by this inner sense of guilt, of recriminating oneself for being, in so many words, a living being that wants to strike out against that which does it harm. An animal with sexual impulses, violent impulses, cruel or excessive impulses. This dark workshop of the psyche, as Nietzsche calls it, is created by religion, the Christian religion, in which resentment and bad conscience mount upon one another, creating inner tortures never before possible. And that's what Nietzsche sees as the great harm done to the European psyche in the wake of Christianity. He attacks Christianity as a unique evil and having perpetrated this state of affairs upon the human mind. There are some who have criticized Nietzsche on the basis that he simply advocates for a simple-minded return to the Dionysian worldview, as if we could simply go back to the way things were after 2,000 years of Christianity. I would argue that we must bear in mind that Nietzsche said he was attempting to create a philosophy of the future. I don't think that Nietzsche was naive enough to think that we would simply reestablish the Hellenic polis that once were the cultural center of all Europe and forget everything that had been done and said and thought and felt in the long history of Christendom. Nevertheless, it is central to his project, this contrast between Dionysus and the crucified, as he says himself, that there is something which is only elucidated when we put these two starkly different worldviews into contrast with one another, that we see them both all the more clearly in the light of that contrast. And Nietzsche claims that he had found a new approach to the ancient world, that no one before him had really perceived or fully articulated the nature of that profound contrast between worldly pre-Christian values and the otherworldly post-Christian values. And many of Nietzsche's critics have taken issue with this characterization of Christianity, many of his Christian critics, and they have pushed back on him on that basis, saying, you know, that the meek shall inherit the earth, though that doesn't actually mean the weak. That means men who keep their swords sheathed shall inherit the earth. And turn the other cheek might not actually be a call to simply endure evil. You know, there might be some other metaphorical meaning behind it. There's usually this kind of argument that Christianity is not as weak as Nietzsche says it is. But French philosopher René Girard is not one of those types of critics. He is critical of Nietzsche, very critical, but not on the basis that Nietzsche has mischaracterized this contrast. In fact, Girard would agree that Nietzsche was one of the few to recognize this fundamental distinction, if not the only one, before Girard himself, that is. In his 1984 essay entitled Dionysus versus the Crucified, Girard brings this crucial dichotomy to the forefront. Girard writes, quote, "The anti-Christian polemics of Nietzsche have received scant attention since World War II. Why? If they were asked, they never are, contemporary Nietzscheans would probably answer that their thinker's passionate attitude towards religion has lost its relevance. Nietzsche remains, quote, important because of some avatars of his that came to light in recent years, mostly through the ingenuity of French critics. Nietzsche, the genealogist. Nietzsche, the advocate of free play. Nietzsche, the exponent of counterculture. Different as they are from one another, at least in some respects, these avatars are all alike in their indifference to the great struggle that obsessed the last lucid years of Nietzsche. Is there some obscure reason why this should be? Is there something inopportune or embarrassing about the theme? Is it strategically advisable not to insist upon it?" End quote. Girard rightly points out, I think, that this resolutely anti-Christian character of Nietzsche's thought runs to the very core of his philosophy, and it's not an aspect that is necessarily emphasized by the postmodernist figures in France who adopted Nietzsche as their forerunner, perhaps with Deleuze excluded, in my opinion, although I think Girard might be referencing him there by invoking Nietzsche the genealogist. But Girard says no, this is the central orienting principle of Nietzsche's philosophical outlook, Dionysus versus the Crucified. And Girard does not take issue with that framing. He wholly agrees, yes, this is the situation. Christianity was a unique religion that arose to defeat the use of violence to sustain culture. But Girard wholeheartedly throws in his lot with the crucified. His criticism of modernity is not that it is too Christian or still driven by Christian values, rather that modernity has insufficiently carried out the revaluation of values demanded by Christianity. That Christianity wounded vengeance but was unable to fully destroy it. Fundamentally, the choice is between the human world of culture, which is inherently violent, and the worldview that idealizes the otherworldly and attempts to transcend all violence in the name of it. This is Girard's rather unique stance on Nietzsche from a critical perspective. He fully signs on with all of Nietzsche's descriptive assessments, but comes to a fundamentally opposed conclusion as regards Nietzsche's prescriptive conclusions. So today, we're going to consider what we will therefore call the case for the crucified. If this whole podcast has been several different variations, different articulations of the case for the Dionysian, this is the case for the religion of the God who died on the cross, from the Girardian perspective. But before we get into that essay, we'll first consider René Girard's life and background, as well as a few key concepts in his thought that will help us fully understand his critique and his rejection of Nietzsche. René Girard was born in Avignon, France, in 1923 on Christmas Day. He was 16 years old when the Nazis invaded France in 1940. Girard lived under this occupation, and he attended university in Paris while the Germans were in power. Girard told his biographer, quote, "I hated it. I hated Paris. I hated Paris more than any other city," end quote. The reason that Girard hated Paris so much, or one of the reasons, had a great deal to do with the occupation itself. He was a French subject of the Nazis, and so Girard could be stopped by a German officer at any time and asked to present his papers. You were always sort of living under their boot heel in a large city like Paris, an important city like Paris. The defeat of France was also considered humiliating, and living under the Nazi domination created a constant state of paranoia. It was just sort of in the air in Paris at the time. The French people were split between those who'd chosen to cooperate with the Nazis and those who were inclined to fight against them or to aid the resistance. Because of this split, Parisians lived in a state of constant suspicion. Rumors would abound, who had sympathies with the Germans, who had their sympathies with the resistance. Sometimes people would make accusations or use such rumors in order to tar someone else's name. And Girard said that in Paris he lived on an incredibly tight budget and oftentimes went hungry. So he was, it was just a terrible time in French history, and it's likely that this experience, when contrasted with the peace and safety of his upbringing in quiet Avignon, probably shaped his entire outlook on life. After the war, Girard journeyed to the United States in the year 1947. He taught at the University of Indiana. He taught French and French literature. One thing to note is that Girard is not, properly speaking, a French philosopher. Even though there are philosophical implications to his ideas, and found throughout his entire body of work, he never conceived of himself that way. Girard is many things: a historian, literary critic, an anthropologist, a sociologist, a religious apologist. It's almost because he's combined so many of these different approaches to really studying humanity that the scope of his ideas became so far-reaching that the only word we really can apply to him is that of philosopher. Properly speaking, he's a polymath. But in a way, Girard is just a man who began to correlate a series of ideas about humankind from work that he did in all sorts of different disciplines. In this respect, Girard has been compared by several scholars to the 19th century amateur archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann. Schliemann's another fascinating figure who we could spend a whole podcast discussing, but he's known primarily for having excavated the ancient city of Troy. Schliemann, like so many other German boys, it seems, became enamored with the Hellenic Greek world as a child. But his family's station in life was not such that he could go and become an academic. He worked as a grocer. He was a cabin boy on a ship. He learned a dozen languages. And eventually, once he'd made enough capital as a businessman, he was able to journey to Greece and to Turkey, using as his guide the works of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Schliemann believed that there were enough context clues, enough little details given in these epic poems of Homer, that one could follow the clues and locate the city of Troy, or locate the places that Odysseus and his crew visited in the Odyssey. And he was successful. Granted, there were other factors that allowed Schliemann and those he worked with to confirm that the site that they excavated was in fact the city of Troy. But the key point is that Schliemann was using information that he discovered within the poems of Homer in order to formulate a hypothesis about an archaeological truth, or we might say an anthropological truth. Girard is comparable to Schliemann in this respect. Girard comes to believe that contained within works of fiction, there is the possibility to discover objective anthropological meaning. That a work of art can be studied scientifically, so to speak, that narrative prose containing imagined stories about imagined characters can nevertheless imply certain facts about mankind, which can be abstracted from the study of multiple such stories. So what Schliemann attempts to do in archaeology, with only the poetry of the period as his guide, Girard seeks to do with human psychology, with only French literature as his guide. The first such insight occurred while he was teaching at Indiana. He was preparing for one of his courses in French literature, and Girard was studying the work of Stendhal, Flaubert, and Proust, three French authors who he was teaching, so that the Americans could learn to read French, basically. But in the course of comparing their ideas, Girard found that, different as the three writers were, their works seemed to suggest or hint at the same underlying model of human desire that he would eventually come to call mimetic desire. And that's a key concept in Girard, one that bears elaborating upon. But we should consider, first of all, how Girard sets himself against the trend that was very much in vogue at the time, especially among French writers and French literary critics. And that trend is postmodernism. The postmodern deconstructionist trend would eventually arrive at a position quite opposite of Girard, that the meaning of a text is something imposed upon it, something perspectival and subjective in the highest degree, that the text is written anew each time it is read. Girard, on the other hand, quite unabashedly asserts that a text contains universal meaning, universal insofar as it could reveal things about all humankind and not just one person's subjective perspective, and that you could distill this meaning by studying the text sincerely and attempting to discover, uncover that meaning in the way that you attempt to excavate an archaeological site. And it's not something simply imposed or added on that will be different with every single reader that encounters a text. The mimetic theory of desire that Girard first finds in Proust, Stendhal, and Flaubert is a theory of human desire that runs contrary to both what I would characterize as the conventional view of desire, or perhaps we might say the implicit premises beneath the ordinary way that we tend to think about desire. But he also challenges the view, the conventional view, in a manner that's opposite of what we might characterize as a Deleuzian notion of desire. Deleuze being one of those postmodernists. So I guess let me elaborate on what I mean by that. In the ordinary way of thinking about desire, we say, I desire X. I have a desire for this object, or even this person, or this occupation, or this place of status, maybe even a desire for a more abstract thing like respect, prestige, a legacy, so on and so forth. And implicit in this model, in the ordinary way of thinking about desire, perhaps simply because of our grammar, is the idea that the external object or thing causes the desire for it, or that it has some kind of pull of the desirer to the desired thing. So speaking in terms of hunger, you smell some good cooking, and that's what makes you desire the food that's being cooked. We've all seen a cartoon character walking by, you know, a hot pot of good food, and the steam rises up and physically goes inside of his nostrils. And it's like a hook, like a fish at the end of a hook, right? That's what the desire is like. It's a hook that gets into you and pulls you towards the thing. Or you see a beautiful woman and you desire the woman. It's her attractiveness that attracts you to her. We use that same language of attraction as if the woman is magnetic, right? That the thing has some inherent value within it, and as a valuing being, you seek after that desire, therefore, that desire of yours. Now, somebody like Deleuze would say that is a reactive picture of how desiring works. You're putting the external stimulus as the active force and treating your desiring as a reaction to that stimulus. But desire, true desire, is an affirmative desire. In other words, if we were to take a Freudian view, let's say one has a sexual impulse, but that impulse is not itself caused or created by seeing an attractive person. The sexual impulse is fundamental, it's basic, it's arbitrary. It's a desire that exists first. It exists first and foremost, and then it latches on to the objects of said desire, attractive people in this case. But the desire itself is primary. It's not caused by the attractive person. And such desires as the sexual impulse are so primary for Freud, for example, that all of your other pursuits are actually seen as sublimations of these more fundamental instincts, such that your desire to attain status, to attain wealth, is now understood as an indirect means of acquiring sexual partners. Such that we might say, to use Deleuzian terms again, the sexual impulse is active, and all of our other impulses in that case, for wealth and status and so on, are in a reactive relationship with that primary impulse, serving the function of facilitating, regulating, or otherwise fulfilling the purpose of the active and primary impulse. So, the object of desire does not cause it. And in fact, even desires which may appear to be in the thrall of some external object, really, they're just serving some underlying fundamental active desire. The desire comes first. The model of desiring that Girard says he discovers is quite different from either the conventional view or the Deleuzian or Freudian view, and arguably, it's quite different from the view of Nietzsche, I might add, although there are important caveats to that. In any case, Girard's model of desiring can be described as a triangulating model of desire, in which the desire does not arise from the external object, nor from the internal subject, but rather from an external subject. In other words, from the desires of others. The way that this works is that what I desire is what I perceive that you desire. And likewise, what you desire is what you perceive that I desire. That we triangulate, calibrating our desire for an external object, or designating an object as desirable, because it's sought after by another subject. In other words, why do you seek after status, or wealth, or the most fought-over position in your given occupation? Girard would say, it's precisely because the position is fought over that you desire it. The fact that it is desired by the greatest number is what makes it most desirable. The desire does not, therefore, arise within the desirer, nor within the object itself, as if it's a hook that gets into you, but within the perception that the object is desired by other subjects. Girard argues that this way of desiring is unique to human beings, or rather, it comes into being as a result of the process of hominization, going from animal to human. That perhaps this model, this triangulating model, the mimetic model, is definitive of human beings. That's the thing that makes us human. And I think it's important to say that even though Girard describes it in terms of mimesis as a mimetic desire, it's important to note this shouldn't be regarded as mere imitation or as a conscious choice to imitate something. Maybe we could call it hyper-imitation, as some anthropologists have suggested. But even though imitation might be an important part of mimesis, mimesis itself is not necessarily a conscious process. In fact, we might say it is primarily an unconscious process. One will mimic the desires of others without realizing it and without ever having the conscious thought, this desire isn't really mine. Because once we have a desire for something, then we just desire the thing. In some sense, it doesn't matter where the desire came from. Whereas in the ordinary way that we talk about imitation, there's usually this implication that this is done as a conscious attempt to copy the behaviors or actions of another person. For Girard, mimesis occurs at a deep psychological level, such that the perception of something being desired creates that desire within us that then feels authentic. It has just as much pull as any instinctual inborn impulse. But unbeknownst to us, it's being created by the social reality in which we live, rather than it springing forth as a sort of active affirmative thing, as somebody like Deleuze might imagine it does. Now, the conclusion that I draw is that I think both views on desire are probably correct in different circumstances. That an instinctual inborn desire, I think, would have to exist because desire exists even in the animal kingdom in the form of drive and impulse, even with animals that are not social at all. But it seems to me that a socially influenced form of desire, the mimetic desire, that has to also exist. And I think the conventional view of how desire works, that it's sort of a hook that gets into you from the desired object, I think does nothing but obscure the truth. I think it's completely wrong. It incorrectly places the root of desire in the object itself. Whereas we might say that an inborn desire is a sort of genuine desire that is real. And Girard does not deny this, by the way. He simply says the majority of human desire is mimetic. It isn't actually ours, quote-unquote, and that it doesn't originate within the individual. It originates within the group reality. And that's why Girard says, quote, individualism is a formidable lie, end quote. To the extent that we have an individual identity, we end up defining it by our desires. What are our goals in life? What is our ideal for what our life should be? And so on and so forth. And when somebody lists their likes, their preferences as a way of defining who they are, that's really just a list of things that they desire, right? Viewed from a certain perspective. But if all these desires are coming from either the unconsciousness or are acquired from the group, then the main way that we define ourselves as individuals is largely a fiction. This view of mimetic desire is profoundly important for Girard because it points to something about desire that is explanatory of human social conflict. Conflict is primarily between individuals who share the same desires for something or another, which is of limited abundance. And Girard argues that conflict is something that, quote, the convergence of two or several avid hands toward one and the same object cannot help but provoke, end quote. From the very beginning of human society, human beings acquired their desires from one another and found themselves in conflict or competition on that same basis. Girard argues that we can see this behavior even in apes and in other animals that may share some close common ancestors with us, that one ape will reach for the same thing that he sees another ape reaching for. They imitate on an instinctive level. And there was a great book on this by William von Hippel called The Social Leap, in which he discusses how human beings have these large white sclera as part of our eyes so we can perceive where another human being is looking. We have what is called theory of mind, which means that we understand that other beings can know things that we don't know, can see things that we don't see. So it seems that we're socially equipped to be able to detect where another human is putting their attention, their focus. And for very obvious evolutionary reasons, it might be useful to know where the other members of the same group that you're in are all focused on some other external object or phenomenon. It's very useful for you to be able to very quickly and easily perceive that information. It cues us into the fact that this object or phenomenon is important. And so the Girardian picture of human anthropology is one in which the very thing that makes us human, this mimetic form of desire, is what causes us to come into conflict with one another. But it's arguably that's the impulse that leads to social formation. the focus or attention of the entire group placed on the same object or the same value. And that leads, by the same token, to social dissolution, the struggle for the same object, the same value. We might think of how Nietzsche conceived of the Hellenic Greeks. Each citizen attempted to outrival all others who ran on the same path. They each desired to reach the pinnacle of their art or profession to the exclusion of all the others. Conflict is created where there is this shared desire for something that cannot be shared. And so, consequently, all the desirers enter a strange sort of relationship where they both emulate and model themselves after one another, but also wish to defeat or destroy one another. The fellow desirer is both an ideal and an obstacle. This is the nature of rivalry, and in Nietzsche's view, this is a driver of culture. And yet again, Girard agrees. This is the basis of all human cultures. But the result, eventually and inevitably, is violence. And this leads to the next major aspect of the mimetic theory. This conflict, driven by acquisitive desire, eventually leads to all sorts of disintegrative mechanisms which threaten to destroy human society. We're probably familiar with many of them. Individuals form into subgroups which engage in a struggle for the limited objects of desire, the struggle for the feeding ground. These groups become polarized. They become antagonistic to one another. They begin to visibly denote themselves as part of one group in contradistinction to the other group, and stereotype one another in their thought, and so on and so forth. And they become more extreme. They become antagonistic. And eventually this threatens to undermine the entire purpose of the culture or the state, which is to compress that battle of all against all into a social competition rather than outright warfare, something that can be harnessed for productive ends rather than which is just needlessly destructive. You could say the Girardian argument is that if society is based on mimetic desire, on that model of rivalry in which everyone is in competition with one another, but also emulating one another, eventually you're always on this slide towards open conflict in which subgroups are going to form and battle to get a larger share of the limited abundance of resources that everyone wants. Beneath the social competition, there's always the threat that this bella omnium contra omnis emerges again in full force. And when that happens, society is over. We return to the state of nature. We return to anarchy. Everyone seeking the objects of his desire without a regard for any common law or norm, which is sort of the marker of society itself, right? That society itself is the force which prevents violence as a general means of attaining one's aims. Girard will argue that to restore social cohesion, the various cultures of humankind have all had recourse to a sort of universal process, but which has many varied, different instantiations of this process. This is called the scapegoating process. And it is a use of violence by the group against one of its individuals in order to prevent the outbreak of widespread violence amongst the whole group. What happens is that in times of dissolution, a given society will locate the cause of the social dissolution and sort of place it within a single individual. Originally, Girard argues this was a human being, but over time, the practice is transformed into one of animal sacrifice, just as it is with the ancient Hebrews and their scapegoat, the male goat that was saddled with all the sins of the community and then cast out. This is the name, the ritual for which the process is named. We find these rituals of sacrifice to appease the gods appear time and again throughout human culture. Fustel de Coulanges notably discovered this aspect of ancient Greek society in their archaic period. Before we even have good written records, there's evidence that the Greeks would have given burnt offerings of flesh to their ancestral gods, these benevolent spirits that are bound to the earth that protected the family or the city. An essential part of the rites was slaying a sacrificial victim so that you could give their their meat, their flesh to the gods as a sacrifice, as an offering. The individual targeted by the collective to be destroyed, in effect, focuses the violent impulses of the community all on the scapegoat. It allows it to be discharged on this individual as a means of preventing a widespread outbreak, a total outbreak of violence. The individual, the scapegoat, is then blamed, though their actual guilt or innocence is somewhat immaterial. The community all joins in punishing the scapegoat, in sacrificing it, as an offering to preserve the community at large, offering it up to the divine. And it's important that all the members participate in some way in this ritual of religious violence. And after the scapegoat has been sacrificed, order is restored to the community as a sort of psychological reset that happens. Gerard argues that the memory of the sacrificed victim is not necessarily one of ignominy. Actually, on the contrary, the sacrificed victim is oftentimes remembered as a god, a divine being whose sacrifice had the power to preserve the culture. And many of these sacrificial rites of making these burnt offerings that became sort of rituals or traditions, well, they were just that. They were sort of reenactments of this actual instance of collective violence on behalf of the whole community against a human being, and then sort of commemorated through animal sacrifice as a sort of, you create the superstition that by engaging in this collective sacrifice, you're continually maintaining or preserving the culture. But all of that is only in posterity, regarding the victim as divine and even praiseworthy. In the moment, in the actual moment of religious violence in which all these traditions were based, the bad, the sins of the community, those are cast off onto the persecuted individual. And when the individual is sacrificed, the religious violence that is enacted against them is justified on the basis of the fact that the guilt of the community is being destroyed in the sacrifice. They're making themselves good, affirming the goodness of the collective by punishing and destroying the evil that's responsible for threatening their community. Gerard's biographer, Cynthia Haven, wrote that Gerard, quote, overturned three widespread assumptions about the nature of desire and violence. First, that our desire is authentic and our own. Second, that we fight from our differences rather than our sameness. And third, that religion is the cause of violence rather than an archaic solution for controlling violence within a society, as he would assert, end quote. And so I think that's I wanted to use that quotation because it's a wonderful summation of where Gerard stands in his, you could say, his criticism of many of our common sense notions about how these things work. Gerard's understanding of the scapegoating process, it must be said, is not that this is, in fact, a meaningless act of victimization. The victim may be innocent, and the act of victimizing them may be unjust from our perspective. But the effect of collective victimization of this innocent individual, in Gerard's view, does actually preserve and maintain culture. He thinks that this type of scapegoating ritual has the real effect of enacting that preservation. And of course, this process is largely unconscious. It's not brought into self-reflection because the community, they cannot in all good conscience understand that they're punishing an innocent victim for the good of the whole. They have to maintain the guilt of the victim, especially when the initial outburst of religious violence is taking place. And that guilt of the victim is quote unquote proved by the restoration of order once the victim is sacrificed or expelled. But this is where the Christian religion enters into the picture for Gerard. The Christian story is the story of a God who is punished by the community, a God who is sacrificed, the victim of collective violence. For the first time, though, the scapegoat in the gospel story, Jesus, is understood to be innocent, radically innocent, more innocent than any other innocent victim. Because Jesus is a man without sin. This is the great unveiling that the gospel stories undertake. to show to the community that their collective vengeance is carried out against an innocent who does not deserve it, and to make their God not the recipient of the sacrifice, but the sacrifice himself. Girard's radical reading of the Gospels is that the sacrifice of Jesus is something that appeases not God, but only humans. That the scapegoating mechanism is a human process. It's not a divine one. And it's to this human process that Jesus falls victim. He is killed in order to appease our own vengeance, not to appease the vengeance of God. And this is the basis of Girard's own Christianity, because Girard sees how, if intracommunal violence is driven by mimetic desire, then the nature of violence is to be self-escalatory. It's a process which always is threatening to run out of control. Perhaps a great example of this would be in the example of the blood feud. In a blood feud, two sides both perceive the other as the cause of the conflict. Both will have some fundamental grievance, some murder or act of violence that was committed against them or committed against their group in the past by the other side. And accordingly, their own acts of violence against their enemies become justified in their minds. But with each consequentially following act of violence, all that happens is that the justifications for more violence are created. The justifications for violence only become heightened. At no point is the score settled. At no point is the need for violence abated. Rather, the sense of justice based on an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth seems to produce this continually heightening desire for vindictive, violent recompense. The account is never settled. The debt only deepens and deepens on both sides. And so in Girard's view, there's no way out of this cycle that is really the modus operandi of mankind. The best we came up with to deal with it was this model of scapegoating. But this process requires the blood of innocent victims in order to grease the wheels of culture, so to speak. And this has to happen continuously. You have to continually renew culture with a new scapegoat. And so the way out of this process of reciprocal violence or of ritual sacrificial violence, in Girard's view, can't come from mankind himself, because we don't know any other way. It has to come from a divine source, and Girard believed that Christianity was just such a divine source. You could say the proof that Christianity is divine for Girard, the proof that Christianity transcends the world, is that what Jesus offers is truly beyond the human. That level of being able to forgive, turn the other cheek against any past act of violence, and a commitment to total nonviolence is the most inhuman form of morality imaginable. And it may be difficult for us to see that now because we don't have that point of contrast with the pre-Christian morality that used to be the universal norm for all human societies and cultures throughout all history. Christianity truly overturns that. And it does this by tearing the veil off and showing us what this process really is. Once we understand the scapegoating process, we begin to understand these things: violence, vengeance, blaming of the external, casting guilt off onto the external. We begin to see all of that for what it really is. It is, for lack of a better word, the road to hell. As with Cain killing Abel, the act of violence does not bring ultimate peace. It merely perpetuates the cycle of violence until Cain's descendant, Tubal-Cain, the maker of weapons of war, leads a clan that will kill 7 times 7 of any group that dares to kill one of them. That's the eventual result of violence, as always, more violence. The only way out is an intercession to halt this process, and since that's beyond human understanding, it has to be transcendent. Nevertheless, Girard's conversion is also situated in a particular time in his life. Girard drew upon the works of great authors from all over the world, such as Dostoevsky, Shakespeare, Cervantes, and many others. He studied the Bible. He began to see his own life in terms of the mimetic competitions and desires of the characters in these great stories. While he'd always been a cultural Catholic, we might say, it was in this state of mind that Girard fully converted to Roman Catholicism. Anne Astell writes of this in Violence, Mysticism, and René Girard, quote, "Traveling weekly by train in 1959 between Maryland and Philadelphia, he was teaching at that time at Johns Hopkins University and at Bryn Mawr, he had had, as he remembers, quote, quasi-mystical experiences in the train as he read, end quote. Enjoyable experiences, connected with a sense of illumination. This first conversion experience made no pressing demands on him for, quote, any change of life, end quote. Soon after, however, the 35-year-old Girard underwent treatment for a cancerous spot on his forehead, and his comfortable intellectual conversion was, quote, transformed into something really serious, end quote. When the worry of melanoma was lifted precisely on Wednesday during Holy Week, Girard, who had not been a practicing Catholic, immediately went to confession. He received the Eucharist on Holy Thursday. His marriage to Martha Girard was sacramentalized and their children baptized. Quote, I felt that God liberated me just in time for me to have a real Easter experience, a death and resurrection experience, end quote, Girard recalls. And end quote to that whole Anne Astell passage. So with these key ideas of Girard's now established, we'll take a look at his essay, Dionysus versus the Crucified, in which Girard gives his overall interpretation of Nietzsche and Nietzsche's significance, as well as his reasons for coming down on the side of the crucified rather than on the side of Dionysus. One of the important things that we ought to note is that Girard believes that Nietzsche was one of the few men of his time who comprehended the uniqueness of Christianity. It is easy enough to call Christianity a unique religion if you are a believing Christian, because of course you would believe it to be unique. You think it's unique in that it's the one true religion, right? And conversely, it's easy enough to think of Christianity as unremarkable or just one more superstition among superstitions if you have, say, embraced the positivism of the late 19th century. But Nietzsche is in neither camp. He was an atheist who affirmed the uniqueness of the Christian religion. And the reason why he was in a position to hold this unique perspective involves Nietzsche's deep engagement with the Greek pagan world. Girard writes, quote, "The uniqueness of the Bible and the New Testament is affirmed by Nietzsche in a context directly opposed to Christian apologetics. Nietzsche tried to put his critique of Christianity on a basis less shaky than the one that was already standardized in his time, the great positivistic equivalence of all religious traditions. He knew too much about pagan mythology not to be revolted by the shallow assimilation of the Judeo-Christian with the pagan. He maintained that the Christian spirit tries to stifle life by repressing the most dynamic individuals of a culture. This is the famous morality of the slaves versus the morality of the masters, the one thing everybody knows about the Nietzschean distinction between paganism and Judeo-Christianity. A culture has to pay a price in order to breed a class of higher men. It has to assume even the worst forms of violence. Time and time again, Nietzsche tells us that Dionysus accommodates all human passions, including the lust to annihilate, the most ferocious appetite for destruction. Dionysus says yes to the sacrifice of many human lives, including, not so paradoxically, those of the highest type that is being bred in the process. Already in The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche mentioned the violence that accompanies and often precedes Dionysus everywhere. All epiphanies of the god leave ruins in their wake. Mania, after all, means homicidal fury. Unlike many of his followers, Nietzsche did not turn the Dionysian into something idyllic and inconsequential. He was too honest to dissimulate the disturbing, the ugly sides of the Dionysian." End quote. So there are many, many important points that Girard raises here. For one, something that Nietzsche rages against throughout The Birth of Tragedy, the notion of, quote, Greek cheerfulness that was popular at the time. This was the view of the English romantic pagan Matthew Arnold, who said that the defining characteristic of the Hellenic Greek world was sweetness and light, as he put it. Or we might consider Johann Winckelmann, the preeminent scholar of the classics, who basically launched the trend of Hellenism in Germany. And he held that the Greeks were serene in their greatness. There was this popular image of the Greek culture as a sort of placid, idyllic, simpler, more peaceful time. These were more natural people who liked to frolic in the woods and dance to the piping of satyrs and so on and so forth. Nietzsche, in Birth of Tragedy, says this is a modern anachronism, that only a romantic age could believe this. This is a product of the imagination created by the post-industrial man yearning for a more natural state of being. But when we look to more primitive civilizations, such as the Greeks, what we find is a warlike people, a people driven by this intense rivalry and competition, that all of these little Greek city-states would like to destroy one another out of jealousy and hatred. And most of all, that the Greeks saw nature as something that had to be overcome and dominated. That man had carved out a protected, safe space for himself within the polis, and that he had had to slay monsters and triumph over all sorts of horrors in order to establish that culture, in that they didn't have this sort of romantic view of nature. Nature was a dangerous, terrible place. And the Greek fixation in their art, meanwhile, as Nietzsche points out, is it's focused on war, suffering, agonistic competition. We could say that such viewpoints on the Greeks find their roots in the kind of Rousseauian romanticism that flourishes in the 1700s. And Girard writes elsewhere in that essay, quote, "You find nothing in Nietzsche that recalls the saccharine idealization of primitive culture that began at the end of the 18th century and that we have so successfully revived. At the very height of the great syncretic mishmash of modernity, Nietzsche drew attention to the irreconcilable opposition between a mythological vision grounded in the perspective of the victimizers and a biblical inspiration that from the beginning tends to side with the victims and produces not only very different results from the ethical, but also from the intellectual standpoint." End quote. Another aspect of Nietzsche that's often ignored that Girard draws attention to is Nietzsche's acceptance of the sacrifice of the higher man. His admittance that even the greatest individuals are most likely to simply be consumed and destroyed by the collective. The most unlikely thing in the world is that an individual with great potential will turn out well. Most likely they'll be botched, they will fall, they will fail. And the end of Thus Spoke Zarathustra is the main character, Zarathustra, finally letting go of his pity for the higher man. And so some have criticized Girard, for example, on the basis that he misrepresents Nietzsche or misunderstands Nietzsche. How could Nietzsche be said to be in favor of collective violence against the individual? That's like the opposite of what Nietzsche wrote, right? But I think Girard points out, and rightly, that Nietzsche says quite straightforwardly that the method of nature, of life, is to sacrifice a great number of experiments in the name of its goal. That the sacrificial destruction of innumerable individuals for the sake of advancing the species, that's the method of nature. It's the natural way of things. And even though Nietzsche tends to side with the individual over the collective, it's not as if Nietzsche thinks that this state of affairs can be changed, or that it should be. That this culling process, this ritual destruction of the individual, is in fact the tragic truth about life. And we must learn to accept this and become stronger on account of this truth. The tragic view of life, in fact, can be seen as encapsulated in the acceptance of this very truth about human beings. And so the pagan morality, the tragic worldview, the Dionysian, this is premised on accepting this fact of the collective violence that drives human culture. Girard sees Nietzsche's work as a formulation, therefore, of the same insight that Girard has, just seen from the opposing side, from the pagan perspective, that does not wish to be liberated by the coming of the Christian religious morality, we might say. And so Girard writes, and I'm quoting here in an abridged form, quote, "Nietzsche clearly saw that pagan mythology, like pagan ritual, centers on the killing of victims or on their expulsion, which can seem perfectly wanton. He realized that this type of killing, which is reflected in many rituals as well as represented in myths, is often executed by a large number of murderers. It is a collective deed in which an entire human group is involved. This is the case especially of a well-known text that figures in the Will to Power, under the number 1052. Nietzsche himself gave that important text a title, The Two Types, Dionysus and the Crucified. The second paragraph formulates most clearly the attitude of Nietzsche. End quote, and Gerard then quotes Nietzsche here, quote, Dionysus versus the Crucified. There you have the antithesis. It is not a difference in regard to their martyrdom. It is a difference in the meaning of it. Life itself, its eternal fruitfulness and recurrence, creates torment, destruction, the will to annihilation. In the other case, suffering, the crucified as the innocent one, counts as an objection to this life, as a formula for its condemnation. One will see that the problem is that of the meaning of suffering, whether a Christian meaning or a tragic meaning. In the former case, it is supposed to be the path to a holy existence. In the latter case, being is counted as holy enough to justify even a monstrous amount of suffering. The tragic man affirms even the harshest suffering. Dionysus cut to pieces is a promise of life. It will be eternally reborn and return again from destruction. End quote. And Gerard then continues, quote, Nietzsche obviously felt that the collective murder of Dionysus in the episode of the Titans is analogous enough to the passion of Jesus to be regarded as equivalent. There is a difference between the two, but, quote, it is not a difference in regard to their martyrdom. The italics are Nietzsche's. End quote. So, the similarity between the martyrdom of Dionysus and the martyrdom of Jesus is one of those facts that had led some of those positivistic interpreters of religion to suggest that the religious archetypes are in some sense universal, that there's no essential difference between Dionysus and Jesus, or between Osiris and Jesus, or between Mithra and Jesus, and so on and so forth. And so Gerard writes, and this is just a little further in the text, that, quote, when the anthropologists first observed the great abundance of gods collectively murdered in religious cults everywhere, they felt they had discovered something important, and so did Nietzsche, obviously. This insight provided students of religion with a powerful focus for comparative analysis. This is no sacrificial religion without a drama at the center, and the more closely you observe it, the more you discover that the features common to the martyrdom of Dionysus and Jesus are common to an immeasurable number of other cults, not only in Greek or Indo-European religions, but the entire world. This remarkable similarity is one important reason why the later Nietzsche can resort to a single symbol, Dionysus, for countless mythological cults. End quote. And this point is important, especially insofar as Gerard rejects the interpretation of Nietzsche found in Heidegger, that Nietzsche's invocation of Dionysus represents a sort of unfortunate attempt to revive monotheism, but merely with a pagan character at its center. Gerard thinks this is totally wrong, and he roundly rejects the characterization of Nietzsche's Dionysianism as a kind of non-biblical monotheistic god. He understands that Dionysus is not that. He's a symbol for a human psychological process. The victim, the martyr, and the scapegoating process, which appears cross-culturally and all over the world. Heidegger's misunderstanding here, Gerard argues, is actually ludicrous, and he says it's unworthy of a brilliant thinker such as Heidegger. Gerard draws upon Nietzsche's remarks that there are no moral facts, only interpretations of the facts. And we can find that kind of spirit in Nietzsche's remarks in the genealogy, when Nietzsche's talking about the meaning of punishment, for example. Nietzsche says in his second essay of Genealogy of Morals that punishment has such multifarious origins and so many different functions that one cannot seriously argue that there's a single meaning to be derived from punishment. Although admittedly, Nietzsche argues, we can rule at least one or two possibilities out, such as the idea that punishment creates penitence, which Nietzsche says it definitively does not. But as for what punishment affirmatively means, what function it serves in society, this is interpreted differently according to the many spiritual and moral traditions of world culture. We cannot simply say this is what punishment means in every different context. So to return to the martyrdom of the god figure in the many myths of the world's pagan traditions, Girard emphasizes that the meaning of Dionysus' sacrifice is interpreted differently than the Christian. The Christian interpretation of the death of Jesus is that it was a murder of an innocent victim by guilty victimizers. Girard writes, quote, "One could object that Dionysus too was martyred wrongly and that the Titans were just as guilty from the standpoint of the myth as the murderers of Jesus, and they must have been indeed since they were destroyed by the thunder of Zeus." Nietzsche did not even mention this objection because he saw its superficiality. In all the other episodes of the Dionysus cycle, there is a collective disparagmos, a martyrdom similar to the martyrdom of Dionysus at the hands of the Titans. In all of these, however, the god is not the victim, but the instigator of the mob lynching. Every time Dionysus appears, a victim is dismembered and often devoured by his or her many murderers. The god can be the victim, and he can also be the chief murderer. He can be victimized, and he can be a victimizer. This change of roles that also occurs in most primitive religions clearly confirms what Nietzsche thought regarding the indifference of mythology toward biblical morality. From the one episode in which Dionysus himself is the victim, one cannot conclude that the Dionysian as such condemns violence in the sense that the Gospels do. It is inconceivable that Jesus could become the instigator of some holy lynching. Each time the possibility of lynching occurs in the Gospels, in the case, for instance, of the adulterous woman about to be stoned, Jesus forestalls the violence and disperses the mob. End quote. So let's examine this key point of the changing of roles. Remember that Nietzsche said that the Greeks were a nation of actors, and that it is in drama that the Greeks express their Dionysian rituals. Rather, we should say that the Dionysian rituals evolved into the drama. The Greek tragedy was their most complex and fully articulated form. In this ritual, an actor takes on the role of Dionysus, or later, the role of the tragic hero who's an approximation or an imitation of Dionysus, Oedipus, for example. And like the actor playing a role, Dionysus is sometimes the victim, sometimes the victimizer. This distinction is fluid. This is part of the tragic worldview. This kind of cycle of ritual victimization is the fundamental nature of life, and we are the victimizers one moment and the victim the next. And there's no essential difference between victim and victimizer because the morality of the parties involved is immaterial or irrelevant. To speak more precisely, whether one is good or bad is established by their role in the scapegoating process at that given moment, rather than their so-called actual character underneath. The fact that you have been made into the scapegoat is what makes you bad, because the sins of the community are now cast off onto you. The fact that you are one of the collective murderers makes you good, because you are participating in the cleansing of the sins of the community. Whether one wears the mask of Dionysus or one of his murderers is a matter of circumstances. It's not the essential nature of the character of the people involved. And that's a sense which is opposed to the Christian sense of things, in which Christ is absolutely innocent, regardless of the fact that the Pharisees condemn him or the people betray him or that the Romans crucify him. The meaning, the interpretation of the act is fundamentally not the same as the interpretation of the collective murder as it was understood by the mythological cults. The mythological cults accept this suffering. They accept this murder, and they affirm it. They affirm the suffering and the murder. The Christian worldview rejects the suffering. It rejects this act of murder. Girard is keen to point out that the standard atheistic critique of Christianity might be to suggest that it has an obsession with suffering, but that Nietzsche's critique is precisely that Christianity attempts to put an end to suffering. Girard, again, thinks Nietzsche assesses the situation rightly, that the true character of Christianity is not the desire to expand suffering and violence, but to deliver mankind from these things. And the fact that Christianity has been misused for the purpose of doing violence is a further indictment on the nature of mankind, not on Christianity. It's an indictment on mankind in the fact that we will corrupt anything that we can get our hands on by implementing it as part of this process of continual collective violence. And so the key point, Girard explains, is as follows. He says that Nietzsche, quote, singled out the biblical and the Christian not because Jesus' martyrdom is different, but because it is not. It has to be the same for that martyrdom of Jesus to be an explicit allusion to the genesis of all pagan religions and a silent but definitive condemnation of pagan order, of all human order, really. The Christian passion is not anti-Jewish, as the vulgar anti-Semites believe. It is anti-pagan. It reinterprets religious violence in such a negative fashion as to make its perpetrators feel guilty for committing it, even for silently accepting it. Since all human culture is grounded in this collective violence, the whole human race is declared guilty from the standpoint of the Gospels. Life itself is slandered because life cannot continue and organize itself without this type of violence. End quote. And I must say, Girard, I think, is dead on here in his understanding of Nietzsche. Included in this point is Nietzsche's great difference with the anti-Semites of Germany, in that he sees Christianity as the fulfillment of what first emerges in the religion of Judaism, not its refutation. He sees Jesus and Paul as the most Jewish Jews who ever lived, or however Nietzsche puts it. And Girard admits there's still some amount of ritual sacrifice and victimization in the Jewish Old Testament, but that the Old Testament tends to side with the victims. He uses the example of Cain and Abel, which we've already brought up, insofar as Cain's murder of Abel is condemned and rejected by God. Girard compares the murder of one's brother as portrayed in the Cain and Abel myth to the same story as it appears in Roman mythology, the murder of Remus by his brother Romulus. In the biblical story, Cain is clearly a victimizer and clearly guilty. He's not to be celebrated. His story is meant to serve as a warning to us. Meanwhile, Romulus's murder of his brother is seen as justified. Romulus is still the glorified hero who founded the Roman kingdom. The murder of one's brother is seen as necessary for the establishment of Roman culture, and Romulus is not condemned. We might also think of the story of Abraham, who is told to sacrifice his son to Yahweh, only to have the divine intercede in order to put a stop to the sacrifice. So, the condemnation of violence and sacrifice is perhaps more vaguely articulated at the earliest beginnings of biblical tradition, because they're still sacrificing, they're still engaging in these kinds of rites. But we could say that the Old Testament represents a striving of the human mind to reach that full articulation of this moral stance which condemns violence and stands on the side of the victim. Girard, unafraid to take on some of the most brilliant minds in their interpretations of myth and religion, also places himself in opposition to Carl Jung. He writes, quote, Nietzsche is a marvelous antidote to all fundamentally anti-biblical efforts to turn mythology into a kind of Bible, and that is the enterprise of all the Jungians of this world. Or to dissolve the Bible into mythology, and that is the enterprise of more or less everybody else. End quote. So again, Girard is approaching this from the perspective of the uniqueness of Christianity, and that sets him just as much against the archetypal theory of Jung as it does against Nietzsche. And his difference from Jung, I think, is fruitful to consider. Girard is not a perennialist who would suggest that the same spiritual truths are articulated in every tradition since time immemorial or something of that nature. But that very different ethical and indeed very different philosophical conclusions will emerge depending on whether one sides with the victimizers or with the victim. And that most of world mythology actually, to the extent that we are going to say the same spiritual truth is articulated, it's that they all stand with the victimizers, but that there is a definitive split between that and Christianity. And so to return to the fundamental point, the uniqueness of Christianity is that meaning of the suffering God as the center of the religion, the innocent victim as the center of the religion. His sacrifice, His martyrdom is the same as Dionysus's in many respects, except in that one key difference of interpretation. The sacrifice of Dionysus is good. It's justified. The sacrifice of Jesus is not. It's an act of unjust violence of the immoral community against the just man. And in Girard's view, again, the sacrifice of Jesus is not something that God demanded. It's something that human beings demanded. It's first and foremost something that we did, the collective humanity. But through this happening, we perceive the innocence of all such victims, which raises the possibility of putting an end to the process. Dionysus' death, on the other hand, is the promise of the eternal continuation of this process. So what I'm trying to tease out here is Jesus is supposed to be the end, and Dionysus is the samsaric eternal acceptance of this. Girard considers how Satan is etymologically called the accuser. He's the one who makes the unjust accusation against mankind. The spirit of evil in Christianity, therefore, is just this spirit of revenge, embodied in the accuser, the one who designates the scapegoat, we might say, the victimizer. One of the names of the Holy Spirit, on the other hand, one of the words for the Holy Spirit, especially used by the early church fathers, is paraclete, meaning a defender. Literally means an advisor or counselor. We might think of the word in the sense that one calls their attorney, their counselor, their advisor. The Holy Spirit is the opposite of the accuser. It's the defender of the accused. Christianity thus fully reverses its interpretation of the scapegoating ritual in this way, that in its embodiments of good and evil, the good is the defender of the accused, and the accuser is the unjust, the evil, the embodiment of evil. That's the moral innovation of Christianity. Okay, now, with all of this in mind, we can come to Girard's arguments against Nietzsche, which can be put quite simply. Quote, "Nietzsche's value judgment is untenable," end quote. Further in the text, Girard continues, quote, "Nietzsche's fierce stubbornness in opposing the inspiration of the Bible in favor of victims logically and inexorably led him toward the more and more inhuman attitudes of his later years, which he espoused, in words, of course, rather than in deeds, with a fortitude worthy of a better cause," end quote. So, for one, I love a good bit of polemical writing, and that is a wonderful summary of how you could best go about criticizing Nietzsche, which, you know, as I've often said, I have no problem with criticisms of Nietzsche. I have problems with bad criticisms, and a lot of the criticisms people raise against Nietzsche, you can sort of see their own resentment and their own problems with life and the world kind of coming out and just being projected onto Nietzsche in many ways. But we'll set all that aside. Nietzsche's great error, in Girard's view, is that he is, to put it bluntly, resentful of resentment. Girard says that it's the nature of resentment to make resentment itself its target. The resentful feelings seek out their mirror image, albeit under a slightly different mask, as he puts it. And Nietzsche is a man, as he says in the quote that we just read, who enacts his great task through his words rather than deeds. So we could say that his great spiritual war remains spiritual. It remains felt rather than acted, which is the modus operandi of resentment. And so Nietzsche rages against the values of modernity, which means he rages against what is in favor of what could be, the very thing that he seems to condemn, that whole way of idealistic thinking. He despises the fact that the modern man has become a resentful creature, rife with bad conscience and all these other polluting and corrupting feelings. And Nietzsche perceives correctly that these feelings are the result of tying off the veins of vengeance. These feelings are the result of the fact that we no longer let this pyroclastic flow of collective violence surge forth wherever it may, but that we halt violence, and that we do so in the name of the innocence of its victim. And because we have done this, we have no choice but to become resentful. But Girard raises a simple question in light of this. Is resentment actually worse than the continuation of collective violence against innocent victims? And Girard is quite comfortable to simply say, for his part, no, resentment is not worse. He gives Nietzsche's critique of resentment its due and agrees that resentment is indeed something harmful. But we might think of Girard's life experience as a man who lived under Nazi occupation. He saw the effects of collective violence and of ritual accusation and condemnation of innocent people around him and the sort of climate of suspicion that characterized Paris. He sees the transition from actual ritual violence to resentment to be a positive change in humanity brought on by Christianity. That rather than a degeneration, this represents what is simply an incomplete process in rooting out the spirit of revenge. Quote, "Resentiment is the interiorization of weakened vengeance. Nietzsche suffers so much from it that he mistakes it for the original and primary form of vengeance. He sees resentiment not merely as the child of Christianity, which it certainly is, but also as its father, which it certainly is not. Resentiment flourishes in a world where real vengeance, Dionysus, has been weakened. The Bible and the Gospels have diminished the violence of vengeance and turned it to resentiment, not because they originate in the latter, but because their real target is vengeance in all its forms, and they have only succeeded in wounding vengeance, not in eliminating it. The Gospels are indirectly responsible. We alone are directly responsible. Resentiment is the manner in which the spirit of vengeance survives the impact of Christianity and turns the Gospels to its own use." End quote. So, we might say Nietzsche could afford to hold such an appraisal of resentment, holding it to be worse than the continuation of ritual violence. He could afford to hold such a view precisely because he was from a society that was almost 2,000 years into the process of rooting out ritual violence. Had Nietzsche lived in the period in which scores were settled by physical cruelty, it's doubtful, Girard argues, that Nietzsche would have held this cruelty in such high regard. It's easy to advocate for these things when you have never experienced that type of society. He says that, quote, "such frivolity could only flourish in our privileged centuries," end quote. And so accordingly, in spite of all of Girard's quite willing concessions to Nietzsche's genius, he ultimately condemns him. He's scathing in his criticism of Nietzsche, saying that anyone who follows him as a teacher of ethics is living in futility and spiritual barrenness. The greatness of Nietzsche, he argues, is that he committed so fully to this ideology that he, quote, "paid for his commitment literally with his life," end quote. He sees in Nietzsche a sort of internal war between the Dionysian and the Christian. That versus in the middle of Dionysus versus the crucified is the most informative word for Girard. Nietzsche feels this battle within himself, and it should be noted that during Nietzsche's breakdown, he signed his letters not only as Dionysus, but also as the crucified. It seems that he began adopting both masks at the peak of his mania, and there's undoubtedly something to this critique, at least insofar as the need for such a battle to be fought in the first place suggests that Nietzsche experienced the crucified as a powerful force within himself. Girard says the fact that Nietzsche felt the need to justify even the worst forms of oppression and violence speaks to this very fact. The very impulse to have to justify is itself a motivation that comes out of the Christian. As Nietzsche himself points out, the nobilities of past ages were naive men by comparison to us. They could never articulate reasons for the things they said and did. Nietzsche is not like them at all. He is concerned with articulating a case, with being the advocate or the defender of the Dionysian. Girard asserts this is the kind of spiritual battle that Nietzsche was fighting, and the very method and means by which he fights it are informative. But I do enjoy the way that, you know, even in his harsh condemnation of Nietzsche, you know, saying he became increasingly inhuman in a task to justify the pagan world, You know, he had to heighten his association with the Dionysian in order to banish the Christian impulses from his soul. He had to write so vigorously against resentment because that was his defining impulse. That's what Gerard says about Nietzsche. And all of these criticisms on a psychological level, I think, are very hard to just dismiss or hand wave away. But even in this, again, I love good polemical writing because Gerard still manages to condemn Nietzsche in a way that's somewhat admiring. He sees the uniqueness of Nietzsche, we might say. So Gerard writes, quote, "Paradoxically, Nietzsche is the one thinker in the modern world whose work did achieve something that the Christian thinkers have always failed to achieve. They have never dared. He put his finger on that sword that Jesus said he brought, the sword destructive of human culture, that sword no human being can fail to dread and resent, even though, or is it because, it belongs to what Pascal calls the Ordre de la Charité, or the Order of Charity," end quote. So when Jesus says he comes to set, parent against child, husband against wife, brother against brother, and so on and so forth, for lack of a better word, Jesus is saying, I'm bringing a culture war. I am bringing a war for the soul of human culture. Because the entirety of human culture that has come before me is rotten to the core in some sense. This is a charitable thing to bring this destructive force against all pre-existing human culture. And that's something that, as Gerard suggests here, even Christian thinkers very rarely are willing to deal with Christianity on those terms. They often want to focus on the positive, the salvation, so on and so forth. Now, in the final pages of the essay, Gerard also finds kinship with Nietzsche insofar as he sees Nietzsche's announcement of the death of God as essentially an announcement that God has been collectively murdered. This is very clear, Gerard points out, in that the madman says immediately after his famous utterance that God is dead, quote, "and we have killed him," end quote. The madman says what was holiest and most powerful has bled to death under our knives. He asks, who will wipe this blood off of us? So this is not the language of a natural death. This is language describing a murder. So it should not be called the death of God. We should speak of this as the murder of God. And what's more, this was not a silent assassination. This was a collective murder. All of us, we all have a knife in our hand. We all have blood on us, right? This was an act of ritual, collective violence on behalf of the community against a martyred God. So it completely fits into this model that Gerard has created. And what Gerard finds so remarkable about this is that the collective murder aspect of Nietzsche's God is dead aphorism is so often ignored. And that furthermore, this very reaction is dramatized in the same scene, that the people of the marketplace, who Nietzsche writes no longer believed in God, laugh at the madman and dismiss him as if to ask, quote, "if God never existed, if there is no such thing as God, how could he be killed?" end quote. So Gerard asserts this is the exact same reaction that he's received in response to his own anthropological theories regarding the collective murder of gods across human societies and cultures. His theories have been dismissed on basically the same positivistic grounds. Of course, as Gerard argues, quote, "gods do not have to exist, really, in order to be murdered. As a matter of fact, unless they are first murdered, they will never exist," end quote. And that's a reference to his own theories as regards how these ritual murders are later mythologized by making the sacrificial victim, who was originally seen by the community as guilty and the justified recipient of ritual violence, that victim is made into a god in the eyes of posterity. In their legacy, the victim becomes recognized as the thing that allowed the continuity of the society to continue. And so even though Nietzsche's perhaps implicit insight revealed in this dramatized passage is quite remarkable, Gerard would argue that Nietzsche himself does not fully come to grips with the consequences of this idea. Quote, "if God is always the product of his own collective murder, does not this text really say that the death of the gods is their life, and that the life of the gods is their death? What kind of eternal return of religion is this? Can Nietzsche himself account for all this? End quote. And a bit further down in the text, Girard continues, quote, the aura of this text is inseparable from its dramatic power. And here, as in Greek tragedy and everywhere else, dramatic power is rooted in the collective murder of God. The genius of Nietzsche takes him to the real beginning. End quote. So this aphorism, as Girard has suggested in its comparison to the Greek tragedies that so influenced Nietzsche's thought, it serves a kind of aesthetic function for Nietzsche. The text itself, Girard argues, functions as one more murder of God, insofar as it is a, quote, textual epiphany of the divine, end quote, but remains, quote, the product of a collective murder that the murderers are not aware of having committed, end quote. I want to return here to the value of forgetfulness as Nietzsche sees it, which is a point we covered at the very beginning of this season, but which Girard does not focus on too much in this essay. Nevertheless, I think it's implicit in Girard's words, and it's something that he elaborates on elsewhere. One of the valuable functions of the scapegoating ritual is the very fact that it allows us to put the problem of human violence behind us, so to speak, to forget about it, at least for a time. As Nietzsche himself writes in the Death of God passage, quote, this deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves, end quote. For Girard, the significance, therefore, is that Nietzsche's genius led him to uncover that true origin of all human religion, all human culture. But he mistakes it for a recent event, something brought on by atheism or by positivism, by the scientific enlightenment, rather than, what Girard thinks it is, an eternal, ever-recurring process of human psychology. That we always commit the deed of killing the divine, of killing the innocent victim, and this very ritualized process is the thing that allows us to forget about it, to bury the deed and then move on. And that something within Nietzsche, expressed by his madman, wishes to bring this terrible fact about human culture to light, to expose it, much in the same way that Christianity exposed it. Yet again, the crucified operates within the psyche of Nietzsche much more so than he himself would have liked to admit. And accordingly, the madman, after giving his great speech, goes to the temples, thereafter consecrating them and affording the old worship places of God a kind of holiness or dignity. These are the tombs and sepulchres of the old God. And so near the conclusion of this work of Girard's, Dionysus versus the Crucified, he writes the following, summarizing several primary levels at which the death of God works in Nietzsche's aphorism 125 of the Gay Science, which he says contaminate one another, but can nevertheless be logically distinguished from one another. He writes, quote, the most obvious level is the modern disappearance of God as a collective murder. A little behind comes the collective murder of the pagan gods as the generative power behind their existence. And way behind, the most difficult level of all, is the passion of Jesus that cannot be the death of the Christian God if the murders of the gods are always their birth. End quote. Girard continues further down, quote, what are we to do with such a maelstrom of collective murders? In order to make sure that the madman makes sense on more than one level, let us listen to someone who certainly is not mad, at least not in our current theoretical gospel, the great Sigmund Freud. A few years after Nietzsche wrote The Gay Science, Freud discovered he thought that all, quote, festivals of purification and atonement, all sacred games, end quote, all the religious rituals of mankind are rooted in the collective murder of some real victim men call God, end quote. Freud wrote those words in Totem and Taboo, a work that Girard admits has been maligned. He says that most interpreters of Freud do not think much of it at all and believe that Freud's conclusions were overwrought. But it's notable that Freud uses some of the same language as Nietzsche here, some of the exact same language. And for my part, I mean, I don't know where Girard stood on this. I don't know what the state of scholarship was on this or what just his overall awareness was. But Freud claimed never to have read Nietzsche, not to have been influenced by him. That is quite obviously not true, and we're going to talk about that in an upcoming episode. But, you know, Freud invokes festivals of purification and atonement and sacred games. We could compare those words to those of the madman, quote, "What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent?" End quote. So Freud, I think, is very obviously influenced by Nietzsche, which is funny because he's sort of using Freud as another source that we can say, well, this is a man who's quite obviously not insane. Here's an independent source other than Nietzsche making the same argument. Well, Freud was probably just sort of parroting the arguments of Nietzsche. In any case, we can set all that aside. Girard argues that again and again, the collective murder of the divine is the one thing that we wish to look away from, and that this was the real reason why Freud's totem and taboo was so maligned. He writes, quote, "We are not yet ready. We are never ready for a real investigation of the subject," end quote. And Girard says that's why totem and taboo has been, he says, excommunicated and declared anathema. It dared to talk about the ultimate taboo subject, taboo not in the minds of what we would call the primitive in those days, but taboo in our minds, in the modern mind. Girard admits that the madman's declaration has had quite the opposite fate of Freud's totem and taboo, and that it has, in fact, become enshrined and declared sacred. But, quote, "Idolatry is really the other side of an excommunication, and the results show it. Nietzsche's statement on the collective murder of God is just as ignored as Freud's. The excommunication and the enshrinement are two opposite means to achieve the same end, which is to prevent any perception of a most enigmatic similarity between Freud and Nietzsche on the question of God. On everything else, these two texts are extremely distant from each other, and their overlapping in respect to the fundamental theme of the collective murder of God should provide food for thought. But it does not. Why?" End quote. It's on that question that Girard leaves off. He leaves us to ponder for ourselves. Why is it that we have always pushed this terrifying insight off into the periphery and forgotten about it? Of course, after these meditations on the subject, one undoubtedly has some notion of why. That perhaps deep down within ourselves, we feel the same moral horror at the reality of human culture that Girard feels. Perhaps we intuit that same violent reality at the birth of all human culture that Girard claims Nietzsche discovered. But we shudder at the sword that Jesus Christ brought into the world, and we resent it. That condemnation of the whole history of humanity, the entirety of the human race, as guilty and complicit in this collective violence. Because what would that mean? What would that truly mean for us if we were to embrace that truth? The entire corpus of Girard's work addresses itself to such questions, so I would urge any of you who want to explore him further to dare to ask those questions and to dive into René Girard's work. Whether you agree or disagree with his insights, you can't deny he's a remarkable and fascinating thinker and one who is greatly underrated. Among the critics of Nietzsche, I would venture to say Girard is perhaps the best. His criticisms of Nietzsche give Nietzsche his due while being absolutely uncompromising in the rejection of Nietzsche. Girard has been called one of the most ambivalent thinkers of all time, and there are great nuances to many of the ideas that we've discussed here, and you'll certainly encounter those if you do decide to explore his work. But when it comes to the question of Dionysus versus the Crucified, René Girard has no need to draw upon nuances or to hide behind nuances. He stands on the opposite side of the question from Nietzsche, proudly. His work is a unique and revolutionary approach to articulating the case for the crucified. That's all for this week, everyone. Next time, we're going to delve into a thinker that we discussed a little bit at the end of the episode today. We're going to consider some of the other similarities that Girard does not bring up in this essay that link the thought of Nietzsche with that great psychologist, Sigmund Freud. In spite of the fact that he distanced himself from Nietzsche, it's very obvious that Nietzsche was a huge influence on his thought, and we're going to look at some of the ways in which they provide a somewhat similar psychological picture of the human being, albeit Freud does so with new language and with some new concepts, which I think will be very useful. for everyone to consider, especially if you haven't dived into Freud ever. So join me then to discuss the ego, the id, sublimation, the whole world of the unconscious uncovered by Freud. See you then. Signing off. If you enjoyed the Nietzsche podcast or found it helpful, you can visit us and support the show at patreon.com/untimelyreflections. The link is in the description. Or just share the show with any of your friends that you think might enjoy it or on social media. Thank you for your support.